Welcome to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the recording of a plenary session from the 2016 Australasian Aid Conference, showcasing different perspectives on the outcomes of the Paris Climate Talks.
My name is Frank Yotso. I'm Deputy Director of the Crawford School, and I run the Centre for Climate, Economics and Policy here at Crawford School. That's my area, climate change, economics and policy. That's what I work on. That's what I get excited about. And I'm very enthusiastic about chairing this session here this afternoon. So at the conclusion of the Paris Climate Change Conference there in December, we saw great celebrations, okay? So, and I think there were genuine celebrations by the people who were involved in it. And my interpretation of that is actually is a large measure of relief that you can see in these pictures, right? Relief at the fact that a process that had been going for many years and that had very high expectations behind it was not derailed and, in fact, ended somewhere near where it was hoped to end up. The stars were aligned politically in terms of the leaders who were in charge and their respective objectives and motivations in the key powers. We will hear more about that in the talks that we will hear this afternoon. The agreement, of course, the Paris Agreement overall, great ambition behind it, keeping global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees, with a mention even of 1.5 degrees. And now major questions, of course, how the world community may get there, or at least may get some way towards that great ambition. Nations have put pledges on the table, the so-called INDCs, the nationally determined contributions by each country, and most analysis, including these put out by the UNFCCC, the UN Secretariat, put the collective effort behind these pledges at somewhere in the vicinity of 3 degrees, perhaps the high 2-degree end of the spectrum. A lot of uncertainty around that, but it's clear that what's on the table up to date will not be sufficient to meet the 2-degree outcome. Equally, it's clear that what's on the table is a significantly better global emissions outcome than what would otherwise be the case without any pledges. So key elements of the Paris Agreement, what does it mean? What does it mean for development? I'd just like to mention 3 points that I'm sure will come up in the talks. Firstly, it enshrines a bottom-up framework for global climate policy. Bottom-up meaning the key determinant is national policy makings, nationally based decisions that then come up into a global forum. Question is, haven't we had that for a long time already since the Copenhagen Protocol, or is that a significant innovation? Secondly, the hard distinction traditionally between developed and developing countries in the UN climate change framework is no longer so strong under this new agreement. Okay, now, is this significant? Does it mean that we will see more effective climate action globally with more action by developing countries? And will there be effective support by rich countries to developing countries in that context? Of course, the Australian pledge to devote $1 billion of existing aid funding over the next 5 years to climate change. And thirdly, nationally based pledges, I've already mentioned it. Is it just another set of policy documents, or is it an expression of quite a fundamental shift in thinking that now begins to put climate change at the center, or at least in parallel with a development strategy?
My interpretation of what Paris meant is that of a glass half full rather than the reverse. So that's the message that I have. It's just my interpretation. I think it's perfectly possible to look at Paris with a completely different perspective and see it differently. So if you're struggling, you won't miss anything else. I'll also, following this morning's discussions, I'm going to try to get through this without using the term foreign aid, because I think for reasons that others set out much better than I could, that can take us down a path that complicates things immensely. I think Paris affected at least these interrelated activities. That the importance here is that all of these, the way the global economy works, the development process, Australia in its role generally, the way that markets, carbon markets I'm talking about here, form and are used as tools, and the diplomacy of climate change, Paris had an impact on all of that, and they all connect to one another. People have spoken about Paris as a sudden turning point. That's not the way I see it. I think it was a great triumph. All of those hands raised were raised in relief, as Frank said, but also in a feeling of real accomplishment, and it was that, but it didn't do anything radically new. It consolidated, and there was its importance. It consolidated the new direction which of the global economy in particular, which had been apparent, I think, for some time. And in doing that, in consolidating momentum already underway, it will impart new momentum to these processes. And what do I mean by the change in the way the economy works? It's really the salience of climate change has now risen right to boardrooms in the most important companies around the world. They're the ones who have the money that makes the world go round. And so what they're doing in their change of business models, in their apprehension of the climate change threat to their futures, what they're doing is fundamentally changing the way that our economy works for us. If you want to look at this in detail, the Secretary General's office did an excellent report. It was really a follow-up to the summit in 2014. This report was published just in October, and it covers what they call the inflection points in private sector investment that really will determine whether there is a global, an effective global response to climate change or not. So I've sort of said, look, Paris wasn't brand new, wasn't a radical turning point, but there's a qualification on that. And the reason for the relief is that we've been waiting a very long time for two breakthroughs in particular, I think. The first was a very clear, reiterated long-term signal. As early as Copenhagen, we'd had countries agreeing that we couldn't go past a 2-degree rise in temperature beyond pre-industrial levels. This time, there was no debate about that. There was a lot of debate about whether 1.5 degrees was really the limit, the risk limit that we should take. The debate was not about so much whether it was the right number to keep us all safe. It was really whether it was sufficiently realistic or not, at least amongst those who favour climate action. And the argument was that 1.5 degrees was so far beyond our reach that if we embraced it, we would be undermining the case for a realistic approach to the climate problem. I didn't agree with that, and thankfully, at the end of the day, neither did political leaders. And we now have 1.5 degrees solidly in scope, I think. That is enormously ambitious. Nobody can describe a pathway to it at the moment that would meet all of the other social needs that we know, but it's now something we must work for. And the Paris Agreement, the treaty part of the Paris outcomes, commits us to endeavour to take measures to endeavour to reach that limit. And the second big breakthrough. It's been coming for a long time. It's been coming for 8 or 9 years at least. was the settlement that the arithmetic of the global climate response has to add up, that it can't, none of these targets can be achieved unless all countries, certainly all major emitters, whether they're developed countries or developing countries, are participating and reporting on what they're doing to respond to climate change. So what does Paris mean for development? Well, you can approach this from many different angles, but for me, the key sort of starting point is that the nationally determined contributions that countries took to Paris, and almost every country now has one, these are essentially economic plans. They're strategies, they're long-term plans that incorporate the response to climate change in the broad economic tasks that governments identify for themselves, bringing prosperity. This has been anticipated for a long time, and you know, here's the World Bank from about 3 or 4 years ago. They use the term green growth. I don't like the term green growth much, but James Battley this morning said that that when we talk about foreign aid and assistance, we're really talking in the language that these days is seen by people on the right of the political spectrum as not very fashionable. I think one term which people on the right generally love is growth. They can't get it out of their heads, really. And so I think language like this is deliberately conceived to ditch all the baggage of the past and try to start afresh. I'm not sure green growth quite does it, but I think the task in finding new language to point to different conceptual frameworks is worth doing. And certainly it's got to be, we've got to look for language that will appeal universally. So I think in bringing climate change into the centre of integrating climate change into development process, what the Paris Agreement is attempting to do is follow up on the rhetoric, at least in the climate process and the sustainable development dialogues that have been going on and negotiations, of the importance of climate, of a climate change response to sustainable development. So I think it ticks a box that's really fundamental in the SDGs process, the global goals. I haven't got time to go into that any deeper, of course, but be interested in views of those here of whether that makes any sense if you're looking at it from the perspective of the development community. One other way in which Paris fundamentally changes the development, the view of the development process for those from climate change is that for the first time, really, agriculture is identified as a priority for the global response to climate change. Agriculture until now has been neglected, kept out of the mitigation discussion. It's been part of adaptation. It's been kept out because it was seen as very easy to game if you were looking to do that, and in any case, very difficult to measure outcomes, climate related outcomes in agriculture. But over 100. I haven't counted them yet, but I saw someone else's count yesterday saying 160 countries have mentioned agriculture, mostly for mitigation, but also for adaptation as priorities they have in their, let's call them, development plans rather than nationally determined contributions. I'll come back to agriculture in a minute. There is in the Paris Agreement much more attention given to adaptation. It's seen as a priority. There is, and this is the way these things are sometimes dealt with, There's a very long article on adaptation in the Paris Agreement. I think there's still rather too little, and by that I mean there's not enough rigour applied to the discussion of adaptation in the Climate Convention. This is a core development issue, and we've got people making decisions about it who are core diplomats, not really development experts. And so I think we need to work a bit harder on this in the climate community so that the real work on it can be done by people who know about development much more than people like me. You can't do much without any money, of course, and so what did Paris do about the funding of climate responses? There was a bit of a struggle about whether the $100 billion commitment that was agreed in Copenhagen should be updated and a new number agreed. That didn't happen. And instead, we have a commitment to scaling up funding. And I'm being careful about the verbs I use here because there is this awkward concept of mobilising public and private investment. And there's a lot of disagreement about what that word mobilise means. And if you're trying to decide whether the funding commitment that's embodied in the Paris Agreement is adequate for the task, then it's probably worth looking at the best, in my view, best analysis of what's happening so far, and that was done by the OECD in the Climate Policy Initiative and published in just before the COP. And what it shows is that on the basis of their analysis, and that is qualified in every possible way. In fact, if you look at the report, more of it is concerned with looking at their methodologies than is concerned with actually doing the calculations themselves. And that's, I think, quite right, because really this report was to try to get to the bottom of what this word mobilise really means. But even with a lot of qualifications and scope for criticism that it's too conservative or it's not conservative enough, and both those criticisms have been made, I think this report leaves us with an encouraging view of what's happening in the world. They argue that they calculate that in 2013, $52 billion of this $100 billion, which is the 2020 target, $52 billion had been mobilised, and that by 2014, actually that's $68 billion. Not I've mistyped that. $68 billion had been mobilised. So what that shows is an upward trend of reasonable proportion. And I've just got a signal of that I'd better be a bit more crisp in my description of these developments. The Paris Agreement, above everything else, creates opportunities for Australia. The need now to get to the nitty-gritty that Frank mentioned in introducing Professor Lee for implementation is an area that need is really a gift for Australia. We have world's best technology and expertise in some areas of what's now called transparency rather than MRV, and the agreement imposes a big challenge on developing countries of being able to report suitably, and we can help. And the same is true in agriculture, where there's great expertise in Australia to be able to assist other countries. I won't spend any time on markets, but this is a tool for implementing the Paris Agreement that many countries are turning to, And if you look at the last dot point, there's some quite interesting things happening in the wake of Paris. That they have a collective effect of bringing countries together to collaborate on the market mechanisms that they're relying on. Paris, on the whole, renews confidence in the way the multilateral system can work. Context, you need very effective diplomacy. Very few people could do it as brilliantly as the French did, but you need effective diplomacy to get anything done in the multilateral system. And to get anything done in any part of the multilateral system, you need US leadership. US participation is not enough. The US still is unique in the world and in the multilateral system. And last year, Obama didn't shake a hand all year without mentioning climate change. That had a profound impact and helped, I think, here's the glass half full bit, renew hope. We've got a long way to go yet, but this picture I used in the last 18 months talking about prospects for Paris, I thought it would be successful, but just a sunrise, and I think that's where we are. We've got a very long way to go, but Paris gave us a great start. Thank you.
Let me start with mentioning the very simple and easy question. Is the Paris Agreement successful or a failure? Most of persons say, yes, it is successful. I agree on that. My answer is yes, too. Professor Bamzi just ago mentioned that the Paris Agreement will affect in many areas. And someone say that the Paris Agreement is the first step to end the fossil fuel use. And others said that the we can finally save our planet. However, I'd like to point out the durability of the Paris Agreement. From the legal perspective, Paris Agreement is very durable system responding to climate change. We already have two treaties. One is the UNFCCC. It's a durable one too, but the convention has no specific emission reduction obligation. And, you know, the Kyoto Protocol has the legally binding obligation to emission reduction. However, only 30-something parties included in Annex 1 of convention are subject to the legally binding obligation to reduce the emission of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. However, under the Paris Agreement, all parties should participate in the emission reductions. And they shall submit nationally determined contribution with progression in every 5 years. Progression means the new NDC should make any progression beyond the previous one. And it should, all parties are required to submit their NDCs in every 5 years. So, global participation is very important for durability of the agreement. If only part of the community are subject to the main obligation, it cannot exist for a long time. So, I think global participation is one important factor that makes the Paris Agreement durable. And another thing that I'd like to indicate is the NDC will be included in the public registry. You know, under the Kyoto Protocol, the emission targets of each parties are included in the annex. Generally speaking, the annex is the integral part of the treaty. And to include the, set up the new commitment period, the further negotiation should be necessary. During the previous negotiation, it starts from 2007 and ended in 2012. The Canadian withdrawal from the Kyoto Protocol and New Zealand, Russia, and Japan did not commit their next target during the second commitment period. So it impedes the durability of the agreement. And under the Paris Agreement, no further negotiations are required to set up the next period. As I mentioned already, all parties shall submit their new NDC in every 5 years. And as I mentioned, new contributions are included in the annexes, then that means if the amendment to the treaty, that means all parties are required to take the domestic procedure for ratification. Many parties can face with difficulties in because of domestic economic situations. The amended Kyoto Protocol was prepared in 2012, 3 years ago. 3 years ago, yeah. 4 years ago? 3 years ago, yeah. But it cannot be entered into force yet because of a very relatively small number of parties ratified that amended one. So, but under the Paris Agreement, no further negotiations are required, and no amendment will be made. So, no ratification is required. That's the reason why I can say the durable Paris Agreement is a very durable one. So, I think the Paris Agreement is the first durable system under the in the climate change regime to combating the climate change. And as I mentioned, all parties to the UNFCCC are expected to participate in the Paris Agreement. Global participation can be achieved because of the bottom-up approach. Kyoto Protocol took the top-down approach, and because of that reason, many countries are reluctant to participate in the next commitment period. Bottom-up approach was based on the self-differentiation. That is the proposal of the United States. United States proposed self-differentiation, and it is supported by many of the parties to the UNFCCC. And self-differentiation can contribute to the global participation. That's my idea. And another thing is the adoption of concept which are not reached on consensus. Models. I don't know what the models mean, and I don't know what the climate justice means. But Bolivia had consistently insisted that the inclusion of models in the text, and Venezuela consistently argued that the climate justice is very important concept for Venezuela, so it should be included in the text. But no one responded to that idea, but those are, concepts are included in the preamble of the Paris Agreement. If these concepts are not included in the Paris Agreement, then Venezuela and Bolivia might won't be participate in the new regime. So this kind of efforts of inclusion can contribute to global participation. Yep. Let me move on to the factors in success. There are many things that contribute to the success of the Paris conference. The first factor that I think is the affirmative position of the United States and China. I think you may know, you may well know the position of the United States. The Obama administration have consistently supported the ADP negotiations. Chinese position was not so good. Before the ADP negotiation to establish the new climate change regime since 2020, there was another negotiation. It is called AWG-LCA. It was initiated by the Bali Action Plan. During the LCA negotiations, Chinese ambassador mentioned that there would be no more protocol under the UNFCCC. If my understanding is correct, the Chinese did not want any more legally binding instrument. But as we know, the Paris Agreement is legally binding instrument. It's a treaty. The Chinese position has been changed. I think the Chinese position has been changed because of their domestic air pollution problem. The large cities in China, such as Beijing, Shanghai, suffered from very serious air pollution. And Chinese people always complain against the government's environmental policies. So to resolve that problem, Chinese should reduce the emission of carbon dioxide. So that makes the change of Chinese position in the ADP negotiations. And I should also mention the leadership of France. Before the conference in Paris, there was a terror in Paris, but the French government exercised its leadership in negotiations. It can be compared with the failure in Copenhagen conference. There is a bilateral consultation. The chair mentioned that Paris Convention was the easiest one for me because the climate change negotiations agreed at the last minute, at the high-level meeting. It was relatively easy for me because I'm not a high-level official, just the advisor. The French government held the bilateral meeting. Bilateral consultation with the individual party. One plus one meeting means only ambassador plus one official can join the meeting. Through that meeting, all key issues has been resolved. Yeah. I have 5 minutes. I should mention the strong will of all parties and recognition of inevitableness of all parties. G77 countries, most of developing country parties need financial support. If the Paris Agreement cannot be reached, then they lose the chance to get financial support from developed country parties. So I think most developing countries are strong will to make a deal. To get the financial support. Because of this will, the negotiation procedures are somewhat different from other negotiations before. What I have heard frequently during the LCA negotiation, it was the negotiation was the party-driven process. That means the chair could not do anything because the process is driven by parties. However, during the ADP negotiations, many parties mentioned that asked the co-chairs of ADP to exercise their leadership. So it is very important because they can delete unnecessary or duplicated or unacceptable proposals. So the co-chairs can make very simple text. That's the reason why we can reach the Paris Agreement easily, I think. Professor Bamzi already mentioned that the financial support, that's the first priority of most of G77 countries. And the G77, including the AOCs, small island countries, consistently insist that the balance between the mitigation and adaptation. They want to use more financial resources in the adaptation. So there is a balance between the mitigation and adaptation. That's the argument of the G77 countries, and it was accepted. Let me skip this. This is the system that I think all parties are required to submit ambitious NDC with the information and with the progression. Then those informations are subject to technical expert review under the transparency framework. The most important thing is the trust, mutual trust building. If the other, if one party does not believe the other parties, then they are reluctant to submit ambitious NDC. So transparency framework is very important. And the outcome of transparency framework will be informed into global stocktaking. Global stocktaking is to assess the collective progress. So if there is a gap between the requirements from science and the NDC submitted by country, then we the international community need improve their emission reductions. That will be informed into the parties, and the parties will be required to more ambitious submit more ambitious NDCs. I was asked to explain the position of Korea. Let me briefly explain that. Korea belongs to the EIG group. EIG group is the Environmental Integrity Group, consisting of Swiss, Mexico, Liechtenstein, Monaco, and Korea. It is the position of EIG is between the strongest position was taken by the European Union and next umbrella group consisting of the annexed one parties, including Japan, United States, Australia, New Zealand. And the position of EIG is just below the umbrella group. And the weak point position is taken by the G77. In the Korea submitted several proposals with Switzerland and Mexico and Liechtenstein, but in some cases, there is a different opinions between Switzerland and Korea. Korean position is more similar to that of the Mexico. And domestically, many Korean said that the external negotiation with other countries is much more easier than the internal negotiation with other ministries. As you can easily imagine, there is a conflict between Ministry of Industry and Ministry of Environment. Ministry of Environment has a strong position, and Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which is in the position to make a deal. So Ministry of Foreign Affairs is more close to the Ministry of Environment, but Ministry of Industries, recently the Korean economy has not so good. There are a lot of political, strong political pressure from the industry. That's the one problem that the current Korean government take any strong measure against the climate change. Yeah.
My perspective, as Frank said, I worked on the Gano Review. We put forward some international architecture, which has proved to be completely sort of irrelevant and orthogonal to the direction in which negotiations have gone. And ever since then, I've been lecturing this international climate change. I think I've done it about 6 or 7 times. And trying to understand what's happened in the negotiations, trying to predict what will happen in the next one, invariably getting it wrong, trying to explain to my students why where we're going, why people have different views. So I'm a kind of interested outsider. And for this presentation, clearly Paris was a success. I'm not questioning that. I guess I'm trying to explore what was the nature of that success and what were some of the compromises involved? How can we understand it? And I take this as sort of historical slash geographical perspective to understand it. You know, as I'm sure you know, right, these international negotiations happen every year and they move around the world. And so these are just some of the highlights. Obviously, the Kyoto Protocol was born here in 1997. And then another big milestone, although often seen as a negative milestone, was Copenhagen in 2009. Then Durban in 2011 was when they agreed to negotiate the Paris, what became the Paris Agreement, which was negotiated last year. And I guess what I'm interested in is in this move from Kyoto to Paris, what was the key stop? Was it Copenhagen or was it Durban? And it's kind of interesting question because it's actually become a matter of contention if you read some of the blogs that have come out. So we have Robert Stavins. He's one of the leading climate change economists, and he really stresses Durban. Durban as the big break, as he puts it, when countries agreed to achieve an outcome that was applicable to all parties. And he's written that not just in one, but in three blogs. So he clearly thinks it's Paris that was the key. Whereas then Dan Budansky, key famous climate change lawyer, he really stresses Copenhagen. And he says in many ways, Paris just formalizes what Copenhagen agreed. Paris ties a treaty ribbon around Copenhagen, and he goes as far as to call it Copen Paris. So you've got this interesting debate, and who was right? Well, I think if you have to choose one, you know, I'm going to side with Budansky and Copenhagen. As he says, most of the key elements of the Paris Agreement can be found in the Copenhagen Accord, whether it's the 2 degrees Celsius target, the system of pledge and review, non-binding character, moving away from strict differentiation, which I'll come to later, talking about, you know, the $100 billion. All these started really at Copenhagen. Indeed, they go before Copenhagen. And I know Howard Bamsey was involved in leading many of those negotiations, shifting from Kyoto to a more universal approach. That thing that was applicable to all parties was that all parties should make a commitment of some kind. It could be a different commitment. Different parties make different commitments, that's okay, but every party should make a commitment. And Copenhagen should get that sort of breakthrough moniker because under Kyoto, you know, when Kyoto was agreed, maybe it covered 50% of emissions, but by the time of Copenhagen, with the US withdrawing, developing countries growing quickly, it was down to about 20, and Copenhagen pushed that up to 80. And so that was a clear breakthrough. Of course, Paris has taken it further, and now apparently it's 96% of emissions are covered by Paris commitments. But clearly it was that sort of shift from 20 to 80 that really mattered. So if you have to choose one, I think choose Copenhagen. But, you know, maybe both are important, right? Maybe Stavins is wrong to omit Paris, but maybe Budansky's wrong to... Sorry, maybe Stavins is wrong to omit Copenhagen, but we should nevertheless say Paris did have an agreement. It did have an influence. So how did Paris differ from Copenhagen? Well, you've already heard some of these points. Budansky says there's less differentiation, there's more durability, there are more rules. And I think you can add a fourth, there's more aspiration, right? There's more ambition, 1.5, ratcheting up targets, decarbonisation and so on. But I want to focus on the differentiation because that's also Stavins' point. And he says that throughout the Paris Agreement, it's clear the firewall has been breached. I'll explain what this firewall is if you don't know, but that's the question I want to focus on. How different are Paris and Copenhagen with respect to differentiation? It might sound like a technical point. I think it's important for understanding the agreement. So there are really two arguments that Paris ditches differentiation, right? Budansky puts these forward, so do others. So one I call the universality argument, which is that most of the commitments in Paris apply to all parties, right? Including some of which we've heard, you know, submitting and accounting its pledges, common system of reporting and reviews. And then the second argument is that this Annex 1 division has been abandoned. So the UNFCCC has a list of countries back in 1992. That's if you were a member of the OECD in 1992 or if you're in the former Soviet Union, you're in this Annex 1. And that turned out to be very important because you then had to take on a commitment under Kyoto. And Annex 1, you know, doesn't appear at all in the Paris Agreement. So these are two separate arguments. And it's important to realize they're quite different, right? Each is sort of a valid basis for arguing that differentiation has been ditched. In the first case, well, there is no differentiation, right? It's universal. In the second case, all right, maybe there's still some differentiation, but it's sensible differentiation. It's not based on something on what you were like in 1992. Maybe it's based on what you're like today. So we need to go through these arguments, and this is where I want to express some skepticism. I'm a bit skeptical of both of these arguments. In fact, I think there's still plenty of non-universality in Paris. It's true they don't make any reference to Annex 1 or non-Annex 1, but there are plenty of references to developed countries and developing countries. In fact, if you just count the number of references to developing countries in Copenhagen, it's 39 times, right? 56 up from 36 in Copenhagen, either talking about developing countries or non-Annex 1. All right, now that's just a very crude count, but it does suggest there's still, it's not that universal, right? There's a fair bit of, could be a fair bit of different treatment. And if you look in the, some of the specifics about how these systems are set up, I think that kind of argument is confirmed. This is quite a dense slide. You're not meant to have dense slides. But it tries to argue that on key areas of reporting and on transparency, verification, there is still scope for differentiation. I'm not saying there's no progress towards having a single system, which would clearly be ideal, but there's still significant differentiation. And that's particularly clear on the transparency system, where developing countries are given flexibility. And just to give an example, if you look at the a decision outside of the agreement, but it's still a decision of the parties, it says, well, if you're a developing country, an in-country review is optional. Right? In other words, you could just send your data to the experts. They won't necessarily come and be able to dig around, which is, of course, what they currently can do with developed countries. So it's not clear to me that Paris is so different from Copenhagen, where there clearly were two different sets of rules for transparency for developed and developing countries. And also what you notice, a lot of this is still to be negotiated, right? There is a lot of this still to be decided at the future conferences, so at least there's potential for differentiation to be quite prominent in the transparency system. So that's on universality. But what about this Annex 1 abandonment argument? Because you could argue, well, look, there's nothing wrong with differentiation in principle. It's just we shouldn't be outdated based on this outdated Annex 1. Of course, developed countries should do more, but it should be the developed countries now. So then it becomes, well, who are these developed and developing countries? And you know, despite the fact they're mentioned so many times, there's no list of who's in which camp, and there's no definition, right? So how do we tell who actually is a developed or developing country? Well, there is one way to tell, I think, which is what I call the Article 4.4 test. And that basically says that if you're a developed country, you have to have a particular type of target, which is called this economy-wide absolute emission reduction target. And that means you have to commit to reduce emissions by X percent by Y year compared to Z base year, right? If you're a developing country, you can have that sort of target or any target that you want. But for a developed country target, that's the target you have to have. So if you didn't put forward that target, you're not a developed country. Right? And so we're interested in those countries that are members of the OECD today, but which weren't in 1992, so they're not in Annex 1. And if we're interested in those countries, there are three of them, Korea, Mexico, and Chile. And this is not to put Korea on the spot, right? This is the system that allows this to happen. But none of these three countries, which are now members of the OECD, put forward the target in this prescribed X percent reduction by Y year compared to Z base year. So you have to think that under this test, outside Europe's different, because in Europe they were in the former Soviet Union, they were in Annex 1 anyway, now they're in the European Union. But outside of Europe, the definition hasn't really changed between developed and Annex 1. It may change in the future, and so Paris does introduce some flexibility, but at the moment there's not much different. So to conclude this rather technical sort of discussion, Paris is a little more universal than Copenhagen, but it still matters a lot whether you're a developed or a developing country, including in ways that probably shouldn't matter. It continues to rely, for the time being, on outdated definitions. So I think that firewall, Copenhagen blasted a lot of it away. Ever since then, people have been chipping away, and Paris does a bit more chipping. All right, I'm coming to the end, and I want to go on to the politics, because you know you probably have there's an obvious objection to what I'm saying, right? If Paris is so similar to Copenhagen, you know, why is Paris hailed as this triumph, right? A landmark, a turning point, a flame of hope, and so on, when Copenhagen was reviled, right? It's a fiasco, a failure, a disaster, right? Our own Kay Rudd said we all failed at Copenhagen, right? Well, then why do they get such different receptions? The key answer here, I think, is that they're similar. They're not identical. They're similar in substance, but they're very different in form, right? Now, the tragedy of Copenhagen was that countries kind of agreed on the substance, but they couldn't agree on how to agree, And as Professor Lee said, China wasn't very keen on putting it all on legal agreement. Other countries clearly did want a legal agreement. And that's where I think Paris was really critical, right? Not so much on the substance, but on the form. Right? There, countries finally agreed, well, look, we have to put all this into some sort of legal agreement. And that process took several years. And finally, in Paris, they agreed this is going to be the new treaty. And no doubt for that, the improvements in substance between Copenhagen and Paris helped. They helped give countries confidence that, yes, this is the sort of thing we can sign on to and make durable because it's going to be around for a long time. And so I think simply the passage of time helped as well. People got used to, you know, Copenhagen is a very different kind of beast to what Kyoto was. So, you know, I think a very a simple way of saying it is that Paris is Copenhagen legitimized, right? And this is the contribution of Durban. And what that means in practical terms, and this is, again, a bit of jargon, but Robert Putnam has this term, negative reverberation, and makes a distinction between negative and positive reverberation. And that's really what we're interested in these agreements. Do they help or hinder domestic action? And whereas Copenhagen hindered domestic action, and we saw that in Australia, you know, Paris is going to help deliver, it's going to reinforce the case for positive domestic action. I do want to just caveat that positive conclusion, you know, there is a question whether the good times will last. As I've tried to illustrate, there's plenty for the parties to go and disagree about in the next few years as they nut out the rules under this agreement, not only in the area of reporting and transparency, but that in particular. Countries may hold off on ratifying it until they've agreed those details, as was the case in Kyoto. Even if Obama decides, let's ratify this treaty now while I'm still in office, they may still have, that won't stop the disagreements happening at these annual conferences. And if that then delivers negative headlines, then some of that positive reverberation will be lost. So there are political benefits, but there are also risks around those. So to conclude, you know, clearly this is not a full assessment of the Paris Accord, but I want to leave you with three concluding thoughts. One, on this particular important issue of differentiation, my assessment is Paris and Copenhagen are pretty similar. Second, the treaty ribbon that Budansky talks about, the treaty ribbon that Paris ties around Copenhagen is worth a lot, and that's a real contribution that can be traced back to Durban. And three, to leave you with this thought, there is that risk that the rules of the game will continue to be the sort of central focus of these annual negotiations. And sooner rather than later, the focus has to shift to what countries are actually doing. You know, if we're in this pledge and review system, we need countries to apply peer group pressure and to challenge each other. And I was rather taken aback by this very frank admission from an interview with the Singapore ambassador of climate change around the time of Copenhagen, when he said, well, you know, he was asked about the peer review process. He said, parties have largely refrained from passing judgment on each other's pledges. Right? We've been so desperate to get everyone to agree, we've all been very kind to each other. And, you know, if we are serious about a world, if we are serious as a global community about climate change, surely this has to change.
Okay, well, my question, anyway, is this one. When will the honeymoon be over? Howard, you've got a view on this, I think.
I do. Stephen asked the question, you know, how long will the good times last? I think they'll last till the first intersessional meeting in May. And I think we can expect then fairly substantial pushback on the Paris result. This is the annual rhythm of these meetings anyway, that things just fall over the line at the COP, and then all the losers from that engagement redouble their efforts in the next intersessional, which is lower profile, none of the high political engagement that we have at the COP, and they start messing around with the results and stepping back from them, often from the same delegations that pushed them over the line a few months before. So I'm expecting in May this year that some of the countries who felt that there isn't sufficient differentiation, that the equity issues have not been well enough reflected in the Paris set of agreements, that they'll push back heavily on that. So I think it won't be enough to stop the sort of momentum I was talking about earlier. I think that's now pretty much unstoppable. barring some enormous real-world change, but it will add confusion to the to that sort of glorious UN process that I was trying to wishfully describe earlier.
Rhonda Dixon, Department of Environment. One of the things that's really struck me over the changes over the last 5 or 6 years, which is the period you've been talking about, is the massive advances in technology and the huge reduction in costs. And we had, I don't know, those people who heard Fatih Birol from the IEA just recently, where he was talking about some of the dramatic uptake that there has been in renewables and other clean energy, including energy efficiency. And I was wondering on the panel's view of how much that huge change in the, you know, the affordability of clean energy and all the massive changes along that line influence some of the momentum and getting to the agreement, as well as the diplomatic process.
Let's take that question straight away. Technological progress and the impact on speed of progress overall.
Well, I'm not an expert, but I think as an economist, you know, what's happened to carbon pricing, right? That's where, you know, we had such high hopes, not only in Australia, but in the EU and the US and in Japan, that carbon pricing would take off and countries would reduce emissions as a result of carbon pricing. That really hasn't happened, right? It's a lot more politically difficult. And I think that failure of carbon pricing has harmed the international negotiations. But I think you're right, the counter to that has been the technological progress, right? So it doesn't seem as impossible a task, as expensive a task, right? Some of the benefits are more obvious. So I think, you know, perhaps crudely speaking, those two have balanced the good technological progress, the bad policy progress, but maybe balance each other out.
I think the two things are related, you know, and Stephen's sort of given a version of that. Another way of looking at it is that there's been very patchy progress in policy, but enough to encourage the technology development and the investment that leads to gradually improving affordability of new technologies. Mm. And it's that combination of policy, investment and benefit and the reiteration of that cycle that I was referring to earlier when I was talking about the changes in investment direction that are occurring in the private sector. And the report by the Secretary-General's office measures that, looks at the number of companies who now have internal carbon prices, for example, which in some ways deals with the policy failures. So I think there's a reasonable story on that front, that those trends are all integrated too.
I think the Paris Agreement severely affects the energy policy of all countries. At first, the European Union, European Union to insist that zero emission, but the parties exporting oil, including Saudi Arabia, objected that world. So finally, it was compromised, and the final text is that we should make the balance between the emission and absorption during the second half of the 21st century. So it is inevitable to use the renewable energy and to reduce the fossil fuel energy.
Jenny Goldie from Climate Action Monero. In Paris, we had three ministers. We had Turnbull, Hunt and Bishop, and they all seemed to be making the right noises in terms of mitigating climate change and so on. But since Paris, the government has approved the Adani coal mine in Queensland, the Abbott Point on the Barrier Reef. They have failed to take off the they have failed to shelve the legislation to abolish CFC, ARENA, and the Climate Change Authority. And just this week, we've had CSIRO promising to cut 110 climate science jobs. Now, Can I ask, do you think the Australian government was ever serious in Paris about what they said?
And over you.
Simon Pollock from the Department of the Environment. Just a question for the panel in general. Professor Bamsey highlighted the importance of US leadership in getting the Paris Agreement. And I realise it's always fraught looking into political crystal balls, but I'm just wondering, considering the sort of attitude that the US Republican presidential campaign candidates have towards climate change, what do you think the repercussions could be if we see a Republican president in the White House at the end of this year?
You've got the curly questions now, so...
Can I start with the last one? It's about how long the good times will roll. The most important development in global climate change politics this year and policy and everything else is the US presidential election. You know, I think if you look back in Obama's second term, there's been very strong and consistent US leadership, and that's been critical. And depending on who is elected at the end of the year, you know, we'll see a similar a continuity that and, you know, continuous inter-administration policy is very unusual. And if we saw that on climate change, it would have a really marked effect. But if we have the sort of outcome that we all fear, then I think globally it becomes a huge blow. Could I just make a point? I don't want to talk about in any general terms about the Australian government's commitment. I think I'm being, like many others, being patient and waiting for the political process to unfold a bit further before I think we have a very clear picture of the Turnbull government's policy on climate. But in relation to our... in relation to the obligations of the Paris Agreement, can I just refer to Article 7, paragraph 7C? There's an obligation on the part of all parties to strengthen scientific knowledge on climate, including research, systematic observation of the climate system, and early warning systems. I hope our national research body has taken account of that. That's Article 7, paragraph 7C.
It's a good example, actually, how this agreement could be reflected or should be reflected in national policy action. Perhaps we'll see the positive reverberations over the years to come. Professor Lee, Stephen, did you want to comment on the importance of domestic changes in the US or anything along those lines? Okay, we'll move on to the next question then, which is up here. Please just let me know if you want to ask a question so we'll get the microphone to you beforehand.
Thank you, Frank. Jack Whelan from the Pacific Region Infrastructure Facility. It's mainly a question for Howard, and it's not a flippant question, but in my sort of previous history of experience of at the COP, I always recall that the architecture of the negotiations was just as important as the actual substance of the negotiation. And in my previous experience, the officials were the ones who sort of put the various agreement together, and then the heads of state and government came in at the end and may or may not reach some agreement. And in Copenhagen, clearly they didn't, despite many late nights of last-minute thrashing. Whereas in Paris, in contrast, they brought heads of government in at the very beginning. And they seemed to create a climate of approval that an agreement was going to take place. Now, is that something that you might wish to comment on, about the way in which officials then were able to conduct 2 weeks of negotiations with this kind of comfort zone that somehow they had the imprimatur of their heads of state and government at the beginning?
I think this is this is another element. I'd love us here at ANU one day to look closely at the diplomacy of this Paris meeting. It was just fascinating, really breathtaking, I think. And one element of it was the first day bringing so many heads of government. I didn't really figure out until I was in Paris what was going on here. I'd been in Copenhagen and seen the disaster of having 80 or 90 heads of government sitting in hotels in town, twiddling their thumbs, wondering what the hell they were doing in this joint with nothing to do. And in Paris, they were never going to have anything to do except make speeches. So what was the game? They all came along on the first day and they all said, the result of this negotiation in the next 2 weeks has to be a terrific agreement. It's had to be a great outcome. That's what heads of government always say. But then, and the way I've described this previously, is they were effectively, by their presence on the first day, they were effectively hostage to that outcome 2 weeks later. Because, and this was done in a number of cases, if their officials, their delegations, were being too difficult, then the head of government who was there on day one saying, we will be with you, got a phone call and the officials changed behaviour. So this was a terrific tactic by the French, very effective, I think, not used as much as it might have been, but was a very useful part of this brilliant handling of the whole process.
Someone else who was at Paris, Alex Gossman. This will be the final question, and so if you want to take the opportunity for closing comments as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Shankar. I think you've got to pay tribute to the French for the culinary delights they also provided, which I think kept everybody focused. But a question, talking about what you've just said, sort of the parallel between having the world leaders there and then a decision 2 weeks later, and then the honeymoon finishing at the intersessional negotiations in May, why wouldn't signing at the UN in late April be a parallel process? So actually use the signing of the agreement at the UN to actually then stimulate a positive flow through to when the negotiators get together.
That's a great idea, I think. Yeah. I hope there are some Australian negotiators in the room who'll take it away and play it.
Yeah, I'd more generally than that, and going back to the earlier question as well, I mean, yes, I'm sure Paris was very well handled and Copenhagen, there were various problems, but, you know, there was an overreaction to Copenhagen, to its weaknesses. And I mean, there was an agreement at Copenhagen. Yes, a few countries held out, but the vast majority did agree. And, you know, in hindsight, there should have been much more of a positive acceptance that we've got this new approach. Instead, you know, we went into this very long period, right, from 2009 right through to now. You know, what are the rules? What's the new approach? Is it going to be a treaty? And, okay, we've got somewhere. But, yes, we haven't spent much time actually talking about, well, are we reducing enough? You know, despite the, you know, we've had this whole process, how can we be more ambitious pre-2020? And not a single country has actually said, are we going to do more before 2020? So what I'm trying to point to, it goes to this question. Yeah, I hope that the negotiators don't put all their emphasis, okay, now we're going to nail out the rules. And well, that's the key thing, right, to get the rules, because that's going to take years as well. And, you know, I hope the leaders don't walk away. I hope they now put pressure on each other in terms of the actual substance of the pledges, right? And if they think, okay, well, actually you're fudging the rules, we don't believe you, then they can go on to that. But the starting point should be, are we doing enough? And, yes, the US leadership's crucial. So if the US decides to stop leading, that whole process will be much more difficult, right? It'll be more difficult. But if the US does keep leading, that's, I think, where the progress can be had. And so it would be great if they celebrate the signing, and now let's go on and talk about ambition, because ambition, you know, wasn't reflected in pledges in Paris. They actually talk about challenging each other and doing more, rather than continually refining the approach.
Professor Lee, your thoughts in closing?
Yes. I'd like to emphasize the leadership of COP presidency during the Copenhagen conference. Only 27 or 29 heads of countries get together and they agreed on the Copenhagen Accord. The other heads are staying in the hotel. And then the last day, the former president of Venezuela, President Chavez, addressed that I'm going to leave after saying to my delegation not to agree on any issue. So, yeah. So, no country other than 27 or 9 countries endorsed the Copenhagen Accord. So, legally speaking, Copenhagen Accord has no meaning, nothing, it's nothing. But 1 year later, during the Cancun conference, the decision of the Cancun conference is the copy of the Copenhagen Accord, same contents. But all parties endorsed that Cancun agreement because the Mexican presidency spent 1 year to persuade all parties. So I'd like to emphasize the leadership of the COP presidency.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.